You're listening to Amphibicast.
This week's episode of Amphibicast is sponsored by ExoTerra. For quality products tailored to your amphibian's needs, including everything from terrariums to vivarium supplies and decor, substrate, misting systems, lighting supplies, and much more, visit exo-terra.com or visit your local dealer.
Welcome back, everyone. Thank you for joining me again. You're listening to Amphibicast. I'm Dandre Bates, your host. And this week, I have a guest I've been waiting a really long time to talk to. I'm really happy. We've got a whole bunch of questions that we're going to ask. I've got Diane. You may know Diane as Reptiliatus on YouTube. Amazing content creator. I had kind of Diane on my list for a long time to do an interview, and we're here together, so we're going to get into it. I'm really happy about that. But before we get into it, of course, the usual stuff, the usual housekeeping, as they say. Thanks, everyone, for the support. I know I say this every episode, but I do mean it. The patrons, everybody who leave the nice five-star reviews on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, your favorite podcast player. Great way to support the show. We're up to almost about 150 five-stars on Spotify. So if you've been part of that, thank you very much. It's a simple way to support the show. So if you want to support the show, simplest way, nice five-star review. And if you're looking to support the show because you enjoy the content and you want to kind of allow me that opportunity to continue creating this content, especially with the longer episodes, consider becoming a patron on Patreon. I've got tiers as low as $1 a month up to the $5 a month tier. $5 tier will get you a shout out at the beginning of an upcoming episode. And again, it helps me defer the costs of operating the show, production costs, and the hosting site. I've been doing some longer episodes as often as I can. That does eat up some extra space, so the patronage does help with that. And check out the link tree in the show notes. That'll take you to the merch store. It'll take you to the Institute Ecosystems discounts if you want to get a discount off of a tank, and all the other fun stuff that's in that magical link tree. So you want to go down the Amphibicast rabbit hole, that's your ticket right there. So again, thanks everybody for the support. It goes a long way, means the world to me. So let's get into the meat of tonight. Diane, welcome, man. It is so great to finally get to talk to you. I'm so happy we got a chance to get together. How are you doing tonight?
Dan, thanks so much. I'm really it's a true pleasure to be on here. I've listened to many, many episodes of your podcast, and it's a real treat. So thanks for having me, and I'm doing great. It's a chilly spring morning here in Ontario, Canada. You got lots of rain. Weather can't really decide if it wants to get warmer or stay cooler in the winter months, but it is what it is. Just chilling.
We've been having the same problem down here in New York. It's like once the end of October hits, it's 40 degrees and it rains pretty much every day until like the 1st of May. So we're dealing with that too. It's kind of depressing, but hopefully better days are coming.
Yeah, I hope so too. I don't think it was a good thing, but we had quite a mild winter here, but the back and forth is kind of crazy. It's just, there's a lot of rain through the winter, which is not normal. It's usually the white stuff. And now, we'll see how spring looks in the coming weeks.
The only thing I'm really jealous of Canada is during the summertime when you have the really long days. Like we'll get like June 21st, it'll get dark out around like a little bit after 9 o'clock, and it gets early light out at like 5 a.m. How do you guys up in Ontario, how do you manage the spring solstice?
We do have daylight savings. I mean, in Ontario, it's not that crazy. Like I could probably just look it up right now, but off the top of my head, I think by then, by the end of June, we're probably looking at sunset being around, I don't know. Well, I mean, I can see a bit out close to like 9:45, I'd say. So yeah, it is very nice. I'm all for it though. I like having longer days. I mean, winter with the daylight savings is just very rough. You know, you get out of work or it's like 4:30 and it's getting dark and you're like, okay, cool, that's fine. But I do really like the longer days, and it is nice, and I love being outside in the summer and doing all the things we animal lovers enjoy doing, hiking, herping, etc. So it gives you ample time to take advantage of that, right? So
I went out and I scouted a spot that I scouted a spot I was going to fish. We've got some creeks that it's weird, we've got these like urban creeks that kind of just run through these neighborhoods, and they're the creeks are actually really, really old, but you find some really cool stuff along there, and I kind of like to scout them around this time of year because it's not too dense. And that was fun. I mean, I didn't really find anything interesting. I don't find the frogs here like I used to when I was a kid. But I mean, it's still, you know, beautiful, crystal clear stream. Even if it's flowing like right next to a parkway in the woods, it's still pretty cool. So the scouting opportunities this time of year are pretty nice if you want to check out spots when the weather gets warmer.
Yeah, that is kind of a good point too. Like you underestimate how accessible finding a lot of the animals are before all the vegetation grows in. Like that's what I like about spring herping, is even when things are reproducing, you actually get out there and you can see newts and salamanders and amplexus like in the water, but you know, wait a month or two and all the vegetation grows in and there's no way you can't even access the water, let alone see the animals in it. So yeah, it's pretty cool.
Yeah, that's the one comfort I take in this time of year, is that I get to see things that I wouldn't normally get to see during the summer months.
Right.
So I wanted you to start us off by telling us about you, because you've got this massive YouTube channel, you've created these great videos, but I was wondering if you could back up and maybe tell us about your beginnings. What were your first experiences with animals, reptiles, the natural world? What was the catalyst that set you off on this path, and how did it lead you to where you are today?
Well, absolutely. Yeah, I'd love to share. So I mean, for as long as I can remember, and I often tell this story the same way every time, but like I've had this immense love and fascination for all animals, but truly reptiles and amphibians and invertebrates specifically, probably reptiles mostly to start. I think a lot of that also stemmed from just like growing up watching Land Before Time or Jurassic Park. I grew up in the 90s. Like I was born in 92, so I'm older than a lot of people think. I watched Bill Nye. I'd watched the Kratt Brothers, if you're familiar, like Zaboomafoo and all that, and Steve Irwin. And so growing up, I just always... I was getting into trouble, man. Like I would, in spring, we'd go on a field trip. I remember in kindergarten, we went on this field trip and we're supposed to be learning about farming. And of course I left the group and walked over to a pond because I saw a frog and I wanted to look at the tadpoles and try and catch some, and fell in. And like, I've just always been drawn to these animals. And then, you know, growing up in school, I did struggle a little bit. I struggled with mathematics, and it was kind of at a level where I was concerned about my ability to get into like post-secondary education, college, university, whatever you want to call it, in that subject, because that's how I felt. Like, you know, it was kind of more for me, I was like, okay, this is what I love and I'm passionate about, and that needs to be my course of action as far as getting into that sort of field of interest for a job. So to be honest, I wasn't going about it with an outcome in mind. It was more like, I'm passionate about this, and this is what I have to study to get a job in that field. And I kind of didn't do well, to be honest. I did all right in certain subjects, but frankly speaking, I decided to drop out of school. And the whole time I had this YouTube channel, and I had had it since grade 10. And, you know, I was keeping reptiles here and there as a kid, and I had seen a few YouTube channels pop up when YouTube became a thing. And funny enough, when I, you know, search certain animals I was interested in, there were a few random hobbyists that were actually creating very, at the time, pixelated videos with their little Sony CyberShot cameras, and I don't know what else, of just like whatever. Like I remember at Pac-Man frogs, I loved back then. This is like 2008 or 2009, and there'd be a few feeding videos that I'd go and watch and learn about them from. And obviously, you know, Dear Brian and his channel Snake Bites was very inspirational. And anyway, so coming out of school, it was out of university, making the decision to take a pause and sort of figure things out. It was a form of expression I really enjoyed, artistically, creatively, just sharing my love and passion for the animals that I was keeping. And I had a video or two really take off. One of them was how to build a natural vivarium. And it kind of gave me a glimpse into the world of what a viral video can do financially. And although that was never my motivation, it made me think that at the very least, as maybe a side hustle, I could put more effort into that because I also just really love doing it regardless. And so for a few years, YouTube was sort of like, yeah, just a side hustle for me. But I was always motivated by my love for sharing with others the passion I had and positively trying to educate and even learn, because community is a big thing. And for me, part of community is also learning from others. It's not just, you know, preaching to the choir. Like I want to be able to learn from the people that watch my content. And I've been corrected so many times, and I like to stay humble, and I really appreciate that too. It's part of the process. So yeah, that was my main motivation. And thankfully it over time showed me that this can really bear fruit. And just a bit prior to the pandemic in 2019, I had decided that, you know, I really wanted to jump in this with 2 feet. And so I decided that this is what I want to do as a career, and that I was going to dedicate a year to just really grinding, you could say, and systematically maxing out the potential I would hope to see in having a YouTube channel and doing the social media thing. And thank goodness I am still doing it today. So it's been almost 5 years. And yeah, that's where I'm at. And, you know, I think it's important to remember that there are so many ways for us. I really try to encourage youth. Like, I think school, post-secondary education is very important. And I certainly encourage people to, you know, go to school. But I also think it's important to remember that there are many ways to find a way to indulge in the path or love and interest we have as work. You know, like school isn't the only way to get there, and it can be very hard. Don't get me wrong. Like my route was full of trials and tribulations. It was not linear in any way, but here I am, and I'm eternally grateful to be in this place. Yeah. So,
you know, I have that in common with you, the mathematics issue. In fact, I can even remember the point in my life where that went south. That was right around the time when long division started, which is pretty pathetic. Yeah. But it can do some damage to you because you lose out on a lot of opportunities that you kind of think you'd be good for when you're young, mm-hmm. when you're a kid, when you're idealistic. Because, I mean, I watch a lot of the same people. I watch Steve Irwin, Jeff Corwin. Mm-hmm. I mean, even going back further to what was that guy's name? John Forsythe. That's like really old. But
okay, yeah.
All these people were presenters, and they shared that passion for the natural world, and it was just so impressive to have someone like that be your guide into this amazing world that you thought you'd really never get to see. And then when you go into a career and you want to make either biology or natural sciences, something like that, you want to make that the foundation for your career, and then the math aspect of it becomes an obstacle, I feel you. It's very, very disenfranchising because you say to yourself, all right, well, now I've got this blockade that's kind of preventing me from getting to where I want to go. But, I mean, what you did was, very successfully, I will say, is you were able to kind of circumvent that and make a career for yourself realistically just from scratch, which you really deserve a lot of credit for that. I mean, people who create content and are successful, it takes so much work to get there. Like, I feel like people who, like, they watch YouTube, they watch TikTok, whatever, don't understand the amount of preparation and research and staging and then all the stuff that goes into making, you know, an hour and a half long podcast or a 20-minute video. Mm-hmm. I mean, tell us about that. What's the process that you use to create all of your content? What goes into all that day-to-day stuff?
Sure, yeah. I mean, very, very true. Like, it takes a lot. To be honest, I think being organized is one of the things that I need to be working more on, and I am working on day-to-day. I think, let's just say I'm first and foremost a hobbyist and then maybe a business owner, you know, like it's not my forte in terms of doing things effectively and efficiently. But for me, it really just comes from Sure, there are suggestions and ideas that come to mind, and then folks also suggest video ideas that I like and that they resonate with me. But I mean, I keep quite an array of different species of animals in my home, and so there's never any shortage of interesting things to talk about. Like, as soon as I wake up and get ready and walk into that room, there's something going on, you know, whether it's a species that I'm reproducing that's laid eggs or something hatched, whether it's a plant was neglected and then got thrips and we need to talk about that and how I'm going to use ThripX mites to try and get rid of them. You know, there's so many different things that can happen. Maybe it's loss of life. Unfortunately, a few weeks ago, I had an animal pass away in my home, which is very disheartening. And it was sort of like a bit of an honesty hour and me addressing what I think I might have done as a mistake. So there's always something going on. Oftentimes I do have big ideas that I want to execute and you know, put something together for. But sometimes it's like, I don't know what I'm filming for a video 2 days from now that I want to post. I'm going to walk into the reptile room and tend to everyone as I always do. And the idea is just going to come to me through that action. Like it's sometimes as spontaneous as that.
I forgot to ask, is there a story behind the name Reptiliatus?
Sure. Yeah. So, I mean, it's not very intricate per se, but it's essentially, again, so I started my channel, I think it was in February 2009, so quite a while back. And at the time, I was keeping a few crested geckos, and I mean, reptiles at large. And so I kind of just went, okay, I'm going to take ciliatus or ciliatus, however you choose to pronounce it. For me, ciliatus, clearly, and the word reptile and combine them together. So it'd be a play on the word reptile and a Latin name. So I came up with Reptiliatus, and that was it. It's just that.
Yeah, it is. It's a cool name. And in terms of setting yourself apart from other creators, and I mean, by and large, I mean, at least the people that I follow, if it's to me, it seems like the longevity game, if you want to stay in reptile content, it has to be good. And like what people like you and Mike and like similar people out there, I'm talking about Mike Titula, is like, you guys are like, you said it before, you said you're a hobbyist first. And I think that approach really resonates with people in terms of being a presenter who is also a hobbyist, someone who's also just in the hobby and kind of going through the same day-to-day ups and downs. Like you mentioned, you had an animal pass, which I can agree with you. That's, you know, that sucks when that happens. How much of that goes into the videos? Like, how do I put this? I learned early on, like when I'm doing this, I try to just kind of be myself, you know what I mean? And just not
right.
kind of go with it. So when you're doing right. this, like what's your thought process? Like, do you think about, all right, like, do I focus on getting views? Do I focus on dedicating more attention to this specific topic? What's the thought process that goes through your head when you think to yourself, all right, well, like, this is what I have today. This is what I want to, this situation is in front of me. This is how I want to make it into a video.
Yeah, it's a great question. So, I mean, there's many different thoughts that come to mind. Naturally, if, you know, you're doing this as a living, the success portion of it is important. And there are ways to attain that success more easily, whether it's clickbait, sensationalism, etc. I try to stay clear of that as much as it can work well. I think that it maybe attracts the wrong type of audience. Not necessarily, but I don't know that in the long term it's going to benefit you. I think it's kind of short term gains, and you have to then sort of cater to that sort of entertainment long term if you want it to last, right? Because you might be able to periodically do something a bit more sensational, like, I don't know what, like, I can't really think of anything specific, but, you know, something that might be a bit questionable, jeopardize animal safety, etc. There are people that do these sort of things, you know, getting bit or whatever, and it might, you know, bring in the views. But then again, you then now have this growing audience that's looking for that form of entertainment as opposed to what you hope or aim to share. And I think that's the important thing. So to elaborate a little bit, as a content creator, it's so important that you stay true to your craft. If you're looking to post and share that sort of sensational content and you think you can maintain it and it aligns with your values and et cetera, then by all means, go ahead. But you have to think about what you want to be doing long term. You want to stay genuine. And those are really important qualities because people do see through you. You know, you're a pane of glass. They can tell if you're fake or not. I think in some ways I do use a small bit of, how do I put it? I mean, it's not sensationalism, but you do have to speak with an added level of enthusiasm. Otherwise, you're kind of like, hey guys, so, you know, today my frog ate. Like, you got to be a presenter, right? So there's that. I mean, I'm doing that with my videos. But I am thinking about things like I do see trends. I see, oh, like this video I made on this topic performed very well. So like, for example, I can see a correlation between making build videos, you know, setting up new terrariums, paludariums, upgrading tanks to add enrichment for animals, you know, identifying ways that the terrarium didn't serve the animal in the greatest capacity it could, so we're going to upgrade it. Like, these sort of videos attract more views, and I love making them, so I might hone in on that and try and put out that kind of content more often. Or feeding videos. I find that feeding videos do very well, and rightfully so. It's exciting to see pets eat, and it's, you know, a lot of the animals might be more stationary in nature until that opportunity arises. So it's interesting to see any form of behavior come out of them, like especially with tarantulas and things like that. So I don't know. I for me, it's really important to just stay true to my craft. And first and foremost, I really do feel that I've always, as I mentioned initially, wanted to express myself as a fellow hobbyist. And I try to really maintain that level of humility. I'm truly flattered by the way that some people have approached me and shown their appreciation and thanks in what I do. But I wouldn't be here if it wasn't for any of these people that are choosing to watch and support me and you know, engage with my content. So it really does keep me level-headed and doesn't let, like, the, I don't know, popularity and whatnot get to my head and my ego. So I'm very grateful.
How is it dealing with viewer input? Like, when people post stuff in the comments and whatnot, I mean, your videos get a lot of views. Do you try to answer every single comment? Like, how do you manage the interaction between yourself and your viewers?
Yeah, absolutely. That has become a tricky thing. Initially, or, you know, years ago, I would answer every single comment. And I like to take pride in saying that, honestly, if you go check now, like, you can probably scroll through the majority of my videos and see that I do my best to interact with and engage with as many comments as possible. But it's just becoming ever more impossible to do. Like, there's just not enough hours in a day to do all the things I do and get done. You know, I'm working on multiple platforms now. Like, I'm big on Instagram, like, as far as consistently posting and other things. So I try to engage. I try to create other creative ways to, you know, maybe post a poll on my community page to engage with my viewers that way. That's sort of like a big post that everyone feels a part of making a decision. I have my Patreon account, as you do as well, and I'm very touched by the support I get there and am able to engage and help people. So, because, I mean, I get so many questions too. Like, people are asking me care or health related questions. And of course, I'm not a veterinarian, but if I am able to either recommend a course of action that I see fit, or if it's care specifically, obviously, if it's medical, I usually would just strictly recommend veterinarian intervention. But, you know, it's just too much. So, that's why I also have the Patreon, because then people can, if they really have to get a hold of me, they can do it through there. But for me, yeah, it is tough. I really do try to interact with everyone over all the different platforms and engage as much as possible. And when people suggest video ideas, you also have to be careful. Like, initially I used to say, okay, yeah, like, this person wants this, I'm going to do it. but they may not represent the majority of your audience. And even if 10 or 30 or 100 people or 2,000 people, whatever, in my situation say, do this, it's not representative of the whole audience. And so oftentimes when I'm making these decisions, it's based on that in some level, because of course, if let's say 100 or 200 people like that comment, like do this as a video, that's a lot of people as far as those who are actually engaging with the content, and they're probably the ones that are going to watch it too. So it means something. But then it's also, do I as a creator who's been making videos for X amount of years see the potential in that idea as well? So there is that element as well to consider, right? So
what sort of equipment do you use to film?
So I get asked this a lot. People are always asking me, like they'll just jump the gun and say, hey man, what macro lens are you using? And then I go, oh yeah, I'm using my iPhone 11 Pro Max, friend. And they're just blown away. Cause I mean, that's like a 4-year-old, 5-year-old phone. I use a Sony A7 III for filming my, I guess, talking points, and I have a Rode mic mounted on it. I also use it for like vlogging expos and stuff where you have a lot of, you know, loud noises, and it works great. I am not a avid videographer as far as my ability to use these mirrorless cameras. I kind of just hit the ground running, and I have so much to still learn about all the different, you know, bells and whistles on this camera and maxing out its full potential. But yeah, I use that for that. And then, I'm literally using iPhones for most of the animal shots. So I have an iPhone 14 Pro Max, and, you know, Mike and other friends will just make fun of me for saying this, but I am convinced that they do not film animals up close, small subjects, even with the macro setting, as well as the earlier generations of the iPhones did. And so I had this iPhone 11 Pro Max, and that's what I use. Like all my reels on Instagram, they're filmed with a 5-year-old phone. So, yep, that's my gear or my rig right now. I would at some point love to learn more about macro photography and perhaps get myself a Sony macro lens and start doing that. But the thing with the phones that's also nice is the versatility. You can bring a little phone into a tank and get some really cool close shots, but it's harder to do with a big camera lens, right? And you have to set up a tripod so it's not moving, and with the macro shots. And so there's a lot of things to consider, but yeah, that's what I'm doing.
Yeah, frogs don't always cooperate when you, well, I should, Darf, a tree, like a sleeping Craspidopus is not going to move. But yeah, like when yeah, you, that, like, as soon as, like, when you open up that tank and everything just starts flying off in different directions because they think they're getting fed or you're pulling eggs or something like that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Have you ever done the tank acrobatics where you're trying to get your phone in there up against the subject and you're holding your phone like upside down as you're like, got sure. The door halfway open, and I'm like, why am I doing this? Like, I just get a real camera.
Yeah, but then again, like, the camera's not getting in there for the same shot as easily, and then you also have to add the lighting, but of course, the reward, I mean, is sweet, right? Like, you got Troy, and the footage he produces is just incredible, right, of his animals, and even Mike, so... I mean, I'm missing plenty of people, I'm sure, but there are a lot of people that produce this beautiful footage that I'm so envious of and would love to work towards as a standard. But at the same time, you know, I think what I'm doing does work for the type of content I'm making for now. And these are the sort of things you have to kind of negotiate in your mind too, is like, when do I take that step? Because like a lens like that is almost $1,000 Canadian, right? So, for now, financially, like, I don't feel that the standard of quality of my videos is, you know, getting to a point where it doesn't meet the criteria of what everyone else is producing. So I'll kind of just hang or sit tight and then eventually maybe look into those changes. So, yeah.
Yeah, I guess everyone has their own thing. And mm-hmm. There's, like you mentioned, you know, Mike, Troy. Richard Stewart, his videos are
unreal.
I mean, he's like a real pro with that stuff. And I mean, my wife does like professional photography too. You think that I would have learned something, but I don't. It was never in my learning curve. But yeah, I mean, it doesn't always take the same type of production value to get retention, because when you think about it, a lot of it is just, you know, you're kind of selling yourself, you're selling your persona, and someone like you who's got a very, very significant presence in front of the camera, like that in and of itself seems like that can be enough of a leg to stand on where you don't necessarily need to spend 10 grand on macro lenses and lighting kits and all this other stuff. I mean, don't get me wrong, it's stuff is still awesome, but I don't think it's a deal breaker. I think that people can create content, and as long as that content resonates with an audience, I think that in and of itself is enough for success.
100%. Yeah, there are a lot of very successful content creators that are in the animal or pet niche that film all their videos on an old iPhone. Like, I don't know if you're familiar with Exotics Lair. He does mostly tarantulas as well. And I should have mentioned Richard before too. I was thinking mostly frog people, but yeah, Richard's unbelievable with his videography for sure. Probably one of the highest standards I'd say out of everyone I know. But yeah, with Exotics Lair, I mean, he was just filming all his videos on an iPhone and very just kind of, I mean, this like not in a bad way, but kind of like just in the moment, like zip zap, like kind of not Blair Witch shaky, but like Blair Witch Project is going around the room and filming different elements and getting insane views, like consistently 500,000 views on each video. And it's a testament to, like you said, like the presentation style and it's not always the big thing, like production value. Of course, it does add a little oomph, to say the least. Like, it's very important in some ways, or it can distinguish you. It can help with viewer retention because people are seeing something very impressive in that regard, but it's not the most important thing, I think. Yeah.
And you don't even see his face, Exotic Lair. It's just his hands.
Exactly.
And I mean, like, some of his most popular, I haven't watched his channel in a few years, but the most popular videos were watering videos.
Yep.
He would just open up the tank and just dump water in, and then it would, like, one of the tarantulas would start getting a little spicy. And like, that was enough. It was just like, it would, like, you watch one and then you kept watching them over and over and over again.
Yeah.
Hey, what? I don't know if this is an easy question to answer, but channels that are really, really big, I often wonder how much of the audience is hardcore reptile, amphibian, invert, you know, like that kind of herp world versus people who just kind of enjoy watching this type of stuff. Because I've seen comments where people will say, I've never owned a frog in my life, but I enjoy watching this, or I know I'll never do this. I'll never get a tarantula, but because I even, like, before I was even into tarantulas, I was watching these videos and thinking they were awesome. Do you have any idea about the demographics of the audience? Is there a strong, like, real hardcore hobbyist community there, or does it run a gambit between hobbyists and people who are kind of just more casual viewers who just kind of like watching that stuff?
Yeah, I mean, that's a great question. I can only kind of answer to a certain level because there aren't really ways for me to measure those metrics beyond perhaps, like you said, different comments people will make, or also the way people engage with my question of the days that I try to add to every video. Like, I think a lot of those answers have shown me that a lot of my viewers are hobbyists, but absolutely I do get comments from people that are like, I don't keep pets, but I find these animals fascinating and I like the way you maybe present or share the way you keep them, and it's fascinating. Like, I get those sort of comments, or specific to the animal in that video, like, oh, I don't keep tarantulas, but you know, this is actually really interesting. Or what I get a lot of with the spider arachnid related content is, I was afraid of tarantulas, but I like the way you present them, and I feel you know, more intrigued, and that I could actually learn about these. And those are my favorite type of comments. If it's kind of breaking down or desensitizing someone's fear, then I've, you know, that's like my success for the week, like that I helped someone feel more comfortable to learn about an animal that they might have had, maybe not a phobia per se, but, you know, a bit of a fear around. And I can say from my analytics and such, I could share, I guess, some specifics that it does appear to me that the majority of my audience are people that want to see reptiles and maybe specifically lizards. At least it appears to be that way based on viewership and engagement more recently or in the last year. But I think certainly the majority of my viewers are or seem to be hobbyists. But I guess I also have to reiterate that, like, I'm not certain about that because there's not really a way for me to truly measure it. Might be a cool poll to add to the community page, like, who here actually owns reptiles or arachnids, both amphibians, you know, just to kind of gauge it, who doesn't have anything. Like, and again, like, how many people engage with those polls? It's still not going to be, you know, if you get 2,000 votes, that's 2,000 votes out of 230 something thousand subscribers. So it's tough. It is tough to figure that sort of information out.
Yeah, I was always curious about different audiences and trying to engage them because, mm-hmm. I mean, again, I don't get sophisticated metrics. I really don't. And a lot of the stuff that I get, I honestly don't even pay attention to anymore. I did for like the first couple of years, and now I kind of have an idea of what's kind of normal and what I can expect. But I'm always curious about breaking into other communities. Like, I mean, the heavy hitters are always just the dart frog stuff. But the tree frog stuff will hit really well, too. But then I ask myself, like, you know, there's this whole community of people that are into Pac-Man frogs and into White's tree frogs. And I haven't really done a tremendous amount of content, even though I've kept both in one way or another for years. And I've done some episodes, but I often wonder, is there any percent of my audience that's actually in that realm? Because it seems like the most of the interactions I have are just really with like hardcore dart frog hobbyists. So I think about how can I expand this to include those people and get them engaged as well. I don't know. It's just food for thought, I guess.
Absolutely. And I mean, it's something I've thought about more recently too, because I've also realized that as much as I'm grateful my viewership is doing well and people are interested in the animals I keep, I also recognize that a lot of the animals I keep aren't necessarily animals that the majority of reptile hobbyists are working with. I mean, how many people are keeping black-breasted leaf turtles or Chinese crocodile lizards or, you know, tree monitor lizards, things like that, or dart frogs, frankly speaking, at least anything other than, you know, tinks. So you kind of question, like, would this be more relatable or would more people be enjoying this content if I were working with, say, leopard geckos and crested geckos and bearded dragons? And I do have a few more common animals. Like, I haven't shown it yet, but I rescued a leopard gecko last summer, and I also own a few crested geckos. And I do see that the content pertaining to the crested geckos generally does well because it's arguably, you know, one of the most popular pet reptiles on the planet, right? So that is something to consider tapping into. Like you mentioned Pac-Man frogs. I think whether or not I agree that they're the best beginner frog, a lot of people do choose them as like their go-to beginner pet frog. And so that is something that is like very popular.
I agree with you. I don't think that they're a best choice for a beginner. Mm-hmm. I don't. And I've voiced mm-hmm. that opinion and people are like, you're nuts. I'm like, well, they're great until something goes wrong. And I've had issues with them on and off. I mean, I had a male I had for like 10 years or something like that. And he did pretty yeah. well. But then, you know, sometimes stuff happens. They go off of feed or, I mean, I have more questions for you because I know you've got Cornuta, which is a species that I had once that I'll admit I did not have a lot of luck with, but we'll save the Cornuta discussion for more detail when I get to that. But
sure,
before we get into the specifics, I know you have a whole host of reptiles. We ran on some species, but we are an amphibian show. can you tell us the amphibian species you keep?
Yeah. Okay. Let's see. So yeah, I have, So I keep, well, how many now? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. I have 12 species of, or well, almost 12 species of different frogs. So I keep northern glass frogs, the Hylonobatrachium. It's always a fun genus to say, Fleischmanni. I have granular glass frogs, the Coccinella granulosa. I keep two species of Ceratophrys, the ornate horned frogs, and the Suriname or Suriname horned frogs. And then for dart frogs, I have Tinctorius or Dendrobates tinctorius azurus and cobalts. I keep Ufaga pumilio blue jeans. I'm fairly certain they're like the Nicaraguan variety. I have a pair of Ufaga, I guess I should say Anchocyensis now, if I'm not mistaken, small redheads. And they're like quickly becoming my favorite frogs. I have Dendrobates truncatus. E. anthoi, the Santa Isabels, right? Yeah. Those I have a Crusia hyla craspidopus that I raised from a tadpole. I have a group of Phyllobates terribilis mints, and then I also have some Dendrobates leucomelis Guyana bandids. So a lot of frogs. Yeah.
It's a pretty eclectic collection. I want to ask you though. I want to interject about the Craspidopus. So you raised it from a tadpole. How did you? I have a million questions, but first things first. How did you end up with a tadpole? And how did you? You know what? Just walk us through the whole thing from start to finish. How you got a tadpole and how you were able to raise it into an adult.
Sure. So I mean, I have also documented this for those who want to see a more visual representation of the process. It is on my channel, but it's a bit of a labor of love with a lot of tragedy, unfortunately, as well. So 2 years ago, there was a hobbyist in Ontario who successfully reproduced the animals, and that was already a pretty big deal because I don't think there are too many people that are having a lot of success, at least in North America, with that species. She produced them multiple times, and like not like in I don't know if I would say in frequent succession, like maybe not the best idea, but yeah, like a few clutches every few months or something like that. And so they were advertised on our version of Craigslist, which is called Kijiji. And they were not very expensive. And her logic was that she wanted to make a very expensive frog more affordable to the average hobbyist. And I mean, I understand, because she was saying that her animals were, I believe, imports from, I think, Wikiri. I could be wrong, but if that makes sense, you can correct me. and that she figured they were farmed, or maybe, well, I guess for them, they should be captive bred. But I don't remember the exact origin of her frogs. I understood that she said hers were wild collected and came from Europe, but originally were from South America, something like that. And so she really wanted to just, you know, make the captive bred animals more affordable. Her logic was that we didn't need to have, you know, wild animals coming in anymore. So that was why she was selling them so cheap. Like, I'm pretty sure the tadpoles were $50. That's what I'm trying to say, like $50 to $60, or maybe it was $80. And if you got two or three, they'd be less because she had so many. So I was very excited. I really wanted to work with that species. Understandably, I had my reservations that they were supposed to be, what I had heard, sort of finicky, but she was assuring me that they're super easy to keep. And so Mike Titula, myself, and Alec Brown, Dr. Alec Brown, we drove up, little boys road trip, and went to go get a bunch of tadpoles for ourselves and a few friends. Mike grabbed a few juvenile frogs as well. And so these animals were so easy to keep, honestly. And she said that she's just keeping them in totes with tannin-rich water. And I mean, if you look into how they develop and reproduce in the wild, it's no surprise. You know, they find like tree hollows or rotting, like you see it these logs. I've even heard from friends that have visited Peru and other countries that like they reproduce in the septic tanks of an outhouse. So I don't think they need very clean water, but basically this sitting tannin-rich water, and she was just feeding them. Like, she sort of, like, she had experience, but she said she was just feeding them, like, fish food and things like that, and they were metamorphosing, and then just she had froglets and yeah, a whole generation of tadpoles, which is what I bought. So I bought 4 tadpoles. I kept them first in a container. A few of them were different sizes. Like, I had 2 that were ready maybe a week out. Their front arms popped, and then they climbed out of the bin. And they were doing very well. I didn't use filtration. She gave me some of the water that was with the adults to sort of inoculate it, if you will. Just in case that would even matter. But I figured better to do that than just have them risk any shock going into new water parameters. I raised them on the Rapashi, a little bit of the, what is it now? I'm trying to think. The one Rapashi food people use for frogs. I think it's like the Pleco formula. If I'm not mistaken, people will use that. I also gave them like a high quality, I think it was Northfin fish food. And very quickly they grew up and became froglets, and their tails absorbed and they became more active. And I was feeding them fruit flies for a while. And then I started hearing from other hobbyists that their frogs were dying. And that made me very, concerned. And so I started watching them like a hawk, but not disturbing them too much. The 4 of them were housed together the whole time. I just was using broadleaf pothos in water. Like, it was just kind of like that sort of setup. I didn't have a substrate. I was still keeping them on water. And that's how she had her adults even. It was water with a big stump covered in different epiphytic plants with large broad leaves for them to sleep on during the day. So I was really just trying to mimic what she was doing, because it seemed that she was having a lot of success with that. My frogs did well for maybe 3 months. And then after gaining a little bit more size, I too started noticing the symptoms that other people that had literally tapped out of keeping them, they just sold the rest they had survive off, because they were all getting prolapses and no one really knew what was going on. A few people speculated that perhaps it was the breeder that was maybe overbreeding the animals, or there was genetically something going on. And I'm really not convinced, to be honest. I don't think it was anything like that. I was maybe concerned it was a temperature related thing. I had stool samples, brought in for fecals, and Dr. Alec didn't see anything wrong there. We tried like a lubricant to coax the prolapse back in, but the frogs were just in such shock each time it happened that they just didn't bounce back. I know it's happened where they do, but mine didn't. And so, long story short, even though it's already long, kind of where we were at was that I was down to 1 frog, and that animal survived. I have no idea what happened. And again, the majority of hobbyists that purchase frogs from the same group experience the same thing. I do know several people that, even Mike included, I think he might have lost a froglet or 2, maybe a few more, I don't know. But like, he had a bigger number to work with, but several of his survived, and he ended up selling off all of his. But a lot of other people, like, they bought, some of them went crazy. Like, I know people that bought like 20 frogs or tadpoles, and all of them died. And it was always at that same stage of life. So there's something there. I'm not sure what, but yeah, I basically just have the 1 animal, and it is a very sentimental animal, because I raised this animal from a tadpole, and it's kind of cool. And I believe mine is male. I'm pretty sure I've accurately sexed him. He's doing really well. I would at some point love to get my hands on a female, but unfortunately the most recent import, where I might have been able to get a captive bred animal, is not offering any, so I'll have to just sit tight and wait. But yeah, he's a really cool animal. I really love the frog, and it is a very unique backstory. I don't know how many people I've had the opportunity to raise these more uncommon frogs from a tadpole, so it's kind of cool.
That's the first that I'm hearing of it. Now, did this particular frog prolapse and survive, or it never prolapsed?
It never prolapsed.
Oh, okay.
No.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's...
So, I don't know.
It's interesting because I've seen more, and personally experienced more prolapse in the past, like, 5 years than I ever had. Like, I had two ceratophorus, Cranwell eye. I think I had a total of three of them, actually. And, I don't want to get into too much of the specifics, but one prolapsed almost immediately after getting it. It was a well-established juvenile, and that one prolapsed within like the first week and died. Then I had another one, which I kind of documented that one over the course of a year. That one had a prolapse. I was able to get it back in, and I don't know what it is. There's some kind of X factor there, because these all came from the same place. So I don't know what that X factor was, but I wasn't doing anything differently than I did in the past. Honestly, I think I was doing things better than I did them in the past when I had Pac-Man frogs that would live, you know, 5, 6, 7, even 10 years without any issues whatsoever. And I mean, back then in the, look, I'll put it this way, in the 90s, people kept them on gravel. And I obviously that's not a smart idea today, but even back then never had a single issue. So I don't know. I don't know what that is. There's I don't know if it's just because there's more of them being produced. I don't know if they come from the best stock. I don't know if there is something missing when they metamorphose. Who knows? That's $1 million question.
It is a very tricky thing. I'm not really sure myself. Like, I don't think it's like a vitamin A thing. I mean, what do I know? I can't say for sure. I mean, I especially Pac-Man's, it also seems like there's so many funky mutations now. Who knows if they have any effect on those things? Perhaps they do. But what I found interesting in my case, going back to the Cruzio Hilo, is that I found it bizarre that this was happening at a life stage, like this juvenile froglet, you know. It wasn't immediately after the frog metamorphosed into a frog, or sorry, the tadpole metamorphosed into a frog, at which point you could say, you know, oh, I'm not dialing this in right. Like, there's something I'm doing wrong for this animal to thrive as a frog, and this is happening. It's like the animal is a frog living fine, you know, thriving, eating, etc., tongue feeding, you name it, for 3-4 months, well, maybe not 4 months, 3 months or so, and then suddenly is passing from this very like dramatic, you know, graphic thing. And you would think, you know, I think the first thing that would come to mind for me for a prolapse is some sort of extreme stress from either parasite load or temperature or something like that. And again, I don't know that it was temperature, because none of them had this happen at the same time, so it didn't feel like it was like this shock that they all experienced that symptom. And the parasite, I mean, again, the testing came back clear, so it just wasn't really making sense. I have heard from someone that someone who breeds quite a few frogs, that they found, this is maybe a bit, you know, controversial or questionable, but they are adamant in thinking that the type of food, specifically banded crickets, might be causing issues in certain frogs, that in their experience, after, I guess this was going on like 10 years ago now, when there were all those cricket viruses going on, wiping out the house crickets, and everyone was switching to banded crickets, that they found their whole collection of tree frogs specifically were prolapsing when they were switched to these crickets. So I don't know. Again, is that like, is it something else, or does that make sense? There's so many little nuances or things we don't know about, or we need to look into more. It's crazy.
It's definitely odd. And there'll be some things that I guess we'll or who knows, in 10 years, somebody might be like, oh, that's because you didn't give them enough vitamin K, or something totally, totally weird.
Yeah.
It's interesting though. And how do you have your Craspidopus set up now? Because I know that I know people who've kept them in the very Spartan containers with a lot of success. I know that some people kind of have this idea that more natural is better. And there's been failures with that. There's been a few successes. What's your take on that? How do you keep your Craspy now that it's kind of out of that, I guess, more delicate stage?
Yeah, so I mean, I barely had any info on how to keep these animals prior to like meeting up with this breeder, because I think, isn't it Mike Novi that's having a lot of success with them in the States, if I'm not mistaken?
Yeah, right? Mike Novi has so many species of tree frog that he does.
Yeah, absolutely. So, and I know he has a system that works really well for him, and clearly, and he seems to keep things very sterile and go about it that route, and you know, paper towel and water dishes. And I think that that works a lot of the time. I think, I mean, that's a whole topic in itself, but for some species and some individual animals, bioactive isn't always the best thing, whether it's age and them being able to get around or all sorts of factors. It's not always the best thing. But in my case, I guess I was, as I've sort of touched on, more concerned with replicating what the keeper that I purchased my animals from, just doing what she was doing, because for me, it looked like that was working well for her. And so currently, I'm actually still keeping my Craspid opus the same way. I did think about adding a bunch of soil or substrate on the ground of the enclosure, but I never did. In the end, I just kind of change out the bottom periodically. I frankly speaking, like a lot of, I mean, I do water testing periodically to make sure like the nitrates and ammonia levels aren't too high, but it's fairly infrequent. More times or more often than not, I'm actually just topping off the water to keep it around 1 or 2 inches at the bottom. And it's just a few branches of cork that are absolutely covered in pothos. And that's literally it. There's an LED fluorescent bulb that goes over the top. And I think the top of the enclosure does sit around maybe close to low 80s in the summer, but like there's a gradient that by the bottom, it's just mid 70s or so, low 70s. And the animal is doing good. And I feed it every 2, maybe 3 days, small portion or small feedings, like gut loaded crickets. I dust every feeding with Rapashi Calcium Plus. Sometimes I'll do the Super Vite, and then I also will once a month do the vitamin A. But I've had people say like, oh, be careful with the Craspies. Like they shouldn't eat big prey items. And I was worried about those sort of things, but I mean, my animal absolutely loves eating silkworms and small to medium sized hornworms. And so I kind of prefer doing that whenever I have them. And I usually order them fairly frequently for like a lot of my other animals. So he is eating crickets, but I am doing a lot of just tong feeding with soft bodied larvae. And if it is, you know, chitin or whatever that's affecting their body and causing those prolapses, if that is something that's a possibility, at least I can kind of have a peace of mind that those caterpillars aren't going to be the cause of that, hopefully.
You know, the chitin argument is interesting, because when you think about, and again, I'm just going to kind of speculate here, but when you think about the insect the biomass, and I'm going to, through the magic of the internet, I'm going to pull up something here. So, all right, there's 350,000 described species of beetle. In the United States alone, there's 30,000 kinds.
Right.
So, I mean, that's just beetles. And let's not forget other arthropods, flies and whatnot. So I find it hard to believe that animals that are opportunistic feeders, opportunistic insectivores, aren't coming into contact in wild situations with insects that have very, very thick chitin shells. I mean, are they spitting out some of them? I'm sure they probably are. There's probably insects that have different defense mechanisms, whether it's chemical or whatever. But I don't get that. I feel like there has to be something else at work, because you have animals that they're insectivores. They're designed to eat insects. So it just seems unusual. And for people who are critical of things like mealworms and superworms, why aren't they killing tens of thousands of animals? Why are they, you know what I mean? Like it's just. I don't know. I get the fact that things like impaction and whatnot obviously are issues, but I want to know what that factor is that everything coalesces into this way that you get an impaction. And I mean, I hope I was. I'm sorry. I hope I wasn't like critical of what you were saying about the soft body insects.
No,
but
it. No, if anything, sorry, I don't want to interrupt you there. But if anything, I actually agree with you. I don't agree with the argument. Like I'm trying to stay open minded and entertain that, you know, there may be factors, elements. But to me, it's like, sure, we have to also consider what specific part of an ecosystem is that animal occupying? Are there beetles up in a tree canopy? Like, I mean, I've had the pleasure of seeing Cruciohyla sylviae, if I'm pronouncing that right, in Costa Rica with, and I mean, that animal was nowhere near the ground at the time, so high up in the tree canopy. And so you kind of wonder what it's feeding on up there as far as insects. But at the same time, like, I don't agree that, you know, I just don't see how a species would thrive if it's going to prolapse and die because it ate like the wrong size cricket, you know. That doesn't make sense to me as well. And I think that, you know, chitin and such, if anything, depending how an animal consumes or, you know, chews it up and digests it, like, that's dietary fiber too, right? So it is interesting though. But I agree with you. I think it's more questionable than that must be the issue.
I mean, unless we've just kind of selected for animals in captivity that just can't handle, I don't know. I mean, more and more as the time has progressed, and I've said this a million times, but I feel like we're selecting for things that are not the same as yeah, what their wild counterparts would be. And I feel like that's happening now with Craspidopus. I feel like the Craspidopus that are more sensitive are kind of naturally calling themselves out. Like the ones that you had with the prolapse is like, all right, you got the one that didn't have the prolapse. So that one, right, for whatever reason, all things being equal, if everything was the same in those conditions, that one was able to make it through whatever stressor caused the prolapse in the other three froglets. So, you know what I mean? Like we're selectively breeding on a very fast rate for animals that just do better under the conditions that we provide for them versus what they would have encountered themselves.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, even it is neat. Like, I mean, maybe I should save it if we're going to talk about Ceratophrys or the Pacmans. But
that was my next question. You can get into it now if you want.
Well, I mean, for those, even, I don't know if it's just me, but I have noticed that Ceratophrys ornata, the ornate horn frog, a lot of the animals I've come across, and now I don't know what sort of care they're being offered by the various providers or sellers that were offering them, but like a lot of the animals I've come across seem to have growth deformities in the sense that their back legs seem all wacky or wonky. And I experienced this myself as a kid. Like I remember that I was very careful about my supplementing routine, and the frog eventually like grew, but the back legs were kind of spindly. And so I don't know if that's again like a vitamin A deficiency in the adults they were reproducing. I've also heard that a lot of people have bad luck reproducing that species without, I think, injecting them with hormones, or that the males are just too small or big and don't grab the females, or they're not interested but the females are. I've talked to a few people that have tried to breed that species, so I don't know what it like entails, what ends up being the case, or if it affects them, and as we get more generations of frogs, are they inbred or what's going on? So I mean, there are lots of things to consider. Also, just like from an ecological standpoint, like our evolutionary, is it kind of a quality versus quantity thing? Like are we overlooking that perhaps in the wild a lot of them would pass away too out of a certain number and only a few would thrive? I don't really think so per se, but like maybe it's a thing, you know. How many Pac-Man froglets get eaten by their siblings and upon emerging from the water, right? So with the luring and whatnot. So I don't know if, you know, the ones that would be kind of wonky, like the ones that take longer to develop and are the first to get eaten by the larger, more healthy, robust individuals waiting for them. Like, there's so many different factors to consider as well.
Yeah, all very good points. And that's stuff that I'd considered as well. And I feel like with again, with any explosive breeder, it's not this, we're not talking about a Pomelio that raises a couple of young at once. We're not talking about, you know, even like Terribilis that would lay a clutch of, say, like 20 eggs. We're talking about animals that lay thousands of eggs. And
yeah,
right off the bat, if you have thousands of froglets emerge at once, yeah, some of them are getting eaten. Some of them are getting cannibalized. It's just, it's going to happen. But because we've got such a large need for frogs, it's in a breeder's best interest to make sure that all the frogs get up to a point where they can be,
yep,
sold. And again, that's not to disparage anybody who breeds, not at all. That's completely not what I'm getting at. But you have to ask yourself, how do you do quality control on something that you can't see? You know what I mean? Like you could cull animals that have obvious deformities because you're not going to want that to go out there. But at the same time, again, there's so many more animals now in the market than there were 25, 30 years ago, that do you have more, just by the law of averages, do you have more animals out there now that are not living up to their full potential, we'll say, because of some unknown factor that might normally, like you just said, get naturally selected against, mm-hmm, by them just being eaten?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, it's a very good point. And like, I mean, it's even just like with reptiles, a lot of people, you know, a gecko fails to hatch and they try to cut the egg and help it out. And oftentimes that animal fails to thrive regardless. And it was kind of like natural selection, you could say, or, you know, you don't know, maybe it really wasn't meant to make it. And obviously as animal lovers and breeders, we want to, I guess, I don't know if I say intervene, but we want to see our animals thrive. And I guess it is an interesting kind of more philosophical question, is like, is there something going on there where we're supposed to kind of let nature run its course, even if it's in an artificial setting? I don't know. It's a very great question.
It's a double-edged sword, and you're right. It's one of those things where do you say, and again, it's all a function of public opinion. I mean, really, when you think about this, all the ethics of this stuff is all just, it's human-derived. I don't think that the frogs sit and contemplate their own existence to the extent that we do. But you have a dichotomy here. So do you say, all right, we're going to do very, very strict quality control, and the frogs that we deem are not acceptable to the trade, we're going to cull them, do whatever, you know, whatever you do. I mean, I don't know, sell them off as feeders to snakes that eat frogs, whatever. Or do you say, all right, well, we're going to make sure that every froglet gets the best head start that it can get, and then, you know, whatever happens, happens. So it's a tough thing to do. You know, you could say one thing, you could say, all right, well, you know, we're going to pass the buck to the hobbyist, and if the frog dies, it's on you. Or you could say, all right, well, you know, you guys put too many frogs out there that weren't healthy. There's no right or wrong answer to it. I feel like it's just got so many, it's got so many things that just didn't, can go into it. But I just feel like you'd have to replicate some kind of selection. You'd have to cull or let the animals self cull if you really want a recreation or an accurate representation of the gene pool that you would get through natural selection.
Yeah, no, I mean, I agree with you. It is a very interesting point. Like, and I think that would be the only way you could really achieve it. But again, it's like, even by doing that, there's still other variables and factors that are just missing because it's not in the wild. So it is hard. Like, I can understand the more sympathetic notion that people want to just do their best for each animal. And I don't necessarily think that's a bad idea going into it initially, but then you can kind of start to see, okay, like, how are these animals doing? And then you also have to consider, again, like, as a breeder, you lose control of what is happening with that animal once it leaves your home or your facility, et cetera. So are these animals that are pet quality that someone is going to reproduce regardless of, you know, your recommendation or whatever? So these are tricky things we have to consider. Like, I would say for myself, even though I breed animals, I've haven't really had to ever consider calling something because it didn't fit a certain standard. I guess I haven't gotten to that point or bred animals in any sort of abundance that that's a worry I had.
But yeah, I mean, certainly, you know, if I were reproducing animals in more of an abundance or having to worry or consider those things, it is more of a question. So I don't know. Yeah.
Do you think that people are overly critical of breeders when it comes to, well, I mean, reptiles too, but when it comes to amphibians, do you think people are a little hard on breeders?
I don't think so, because it's hard for me to say much as far as the U.S. goes, because I'm not so familiar with a lot of what's going on besides, like, Mike Novi, and I really admire what he's doing, and even the way he talks about how he reproduces his Craspidopus and how infrequently he does that. You know, there's a lot of ethics there. Like, this is an animal that fetches a high price tag and could easily be producing more of them than he does, but he chooses not to because he wants the animals to be of the highest health and quality as far as what he believes is to be true, right? So, but like as far as Canada, like one of my good friends that I really admire, Mark Pepper, and obviously I know you are all too familiar with and have, you know, talked to, he's, you know, doing amazing things. I don't know that, like, I haven't really heard about the sort of any sort of criticism beyond maybe the argument of sort of naturalistic versus sterile as far as how these animals are raised. I know that we often loosely discuss inbreeding and like how much of that is going on, especially like dendrobates and like, but what control of that do we have? Like, as far as from what I understand, and I want to acknowledge that, you know, I've only really been keeping dart frogs specifically for, I don't know, 4 or 5 years. But from what I sort of understand is, like, you know, there's a lot of interesting history there. And I don't know how many people were keeping track of records of where animals are coming from and such. And so I imagine that to some extent with frogs, it's easy to do a lot of inbreeding, you know, and how big is the hobby in Canada, at least our industry and trade is so much smaller than it is in the States. So if one guy produces a clutch of White's tree frogs, that's already more than enough we're going to need for the country to fulfill the demand, right? So, I imagine that inbreeding, you know, if is something that maybe would come off and or come about easily because people are accessing the same clutch of frogs and unbeknownst to them, if they ever decided to reproduce their animals, they might be coming from the same source if they're not really looking into it. And then, I mean, there's also the question of how much it matters or how many generations it matters. I don't know. I think if anything, that might be the only controversy beyond the bioactive versus sterile thing that I think of. But yeah, I don't know. What sort of criticisms were you thinking about there, if I may ask?
I was thinking of the one of the things that you mentioned, like Mike keeps his frogs or his Craspidopus, and I honestly think a lot of his frogs in very, very simple containers because he's figured out what works for them. And the video that was online on YouTube, a lot of people got really critical of Mike. And I think that that criticism was unfair. People were like, well, you know, the animals don't have enrichment. They don't have substrate. And his rationale was, well, this is not, people have tried that and it's been very, very unsuccessful. So his method worked because he was able to successfully breed a difficult species, raise the offspring and just do generally well with that setup. And that was one of those instances I felt like people really didn't understand the reason, like, why Mike was doing that. And I felt like a lot of the criticism that he got for having them that way was kind of unfair. And I feel like it was a lot of people who really didn't understand what the animal actually needed to thrive in captivity versus what they thought that the animal needed. And it was like, well, look, Mike's the man here. He's the expert. He's the one who figured it out. Let him do his thing. Don't overly criticize him comparing apples and oranges with something else. You know, I feel like that was an example of kind of an unwarranted criticism of Mike's methods. And You know, it's just one of those, it's one of those things. People want to buy from a good source. People want to buy animals that are healthy. But like you said, with like White's tree frogs or a similar species, the ceratophorids, you can get thousands and thousands of animals from a single pairing. And there's such an appetite for them in the trade. It's a double-edged sword. You know, you're kind of damned if you do and you're damned if you don't. You produce too many, do you get the same quality? If you produce too little, do you set them outside of the price range of what people can get into? I mean, there's just a million different arguments you could make.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, it's a good point. And I mean, just to kind of not play the devil's advocate, but like, I understand that I think people that criticize these sorts of things have good intentions and they're looking to elevate the standard. But it is an important thing to really consider, like, our notion and push towards bioactive, like, it really depends. And there are problems that can come with that too. Like, for example, people working with species that are not yet really well established in captivity. So, you know, dealing with animals that may have a parasite load if they're imports, you don't want to put those animals straight into bioactive. And even afterwards, like, there are parasites that, you know, pinworms and things like that, roundworms maybe even, that can be transmitted from farm-bred crickets to our pets. And you know, you can complete a parasite cycle just from not properly cleaning a bioactive enclosure, which is naturally going to be way harder to do than with something very sterile. So I can understand why some people choose to keep animals as delicate as amphibians in that way, and clearly the success speaks to that decision. But I mean, I also do think the other side of it, and they're kind of like two branches, I think that we need to kind of teeter-totter between, is like, we also do want to elevate standard of care and consider enrichment and all these other things, but at what expense? And maybe it's the sort of thing where it's a slow process of learning, you know, like even with these frogs, at least for some people, clearly we had negative experience raising them. Maybe we figure that out first, and it can be kind of a process of growth that happens over time, right? Because I think in a lot of ways, they're sort of in a stage of infancy as far as we've come with some of these animals, and there's a lot of learning to be done. So if something's working well, sometimes it's still good to look at ways to maybe improve it, especially for the sake of the animals, but also it can be all the reason to not change anything for the time being as well.
Agreed. I feel like there has to be some sort of perspective in terms of how you want things to progress. And just because enclosure A works for species A doesn't mean that it works for species B. And at this point, I mean, think about how far we've come in the past 30 years with regards to certain other species that, when I was young, when I was starting out, were pretty much, you know, pretty much DOA. Certain species were just considered so fragile that, I mean, there was a time when crested geckos were considered to be extinct. Yeah. And now they're everywhere. So I don't feel like, I agree with you. I don't think there's really one right or wrong answer. I feel like it would benefit people if they really understood what the process was with regards to breeding species that produce either a lot of offspring or species that produce very, very delicate offspring. Like, I mean, I guess like with the Pimelio, I don't want to say Pimelio is delicate, but the large obligates, you really can't intercede too much.
But right.
I guess
you have to let them do their thing.
Yeah, you kind of have to let certain animals just do it on their own. But
right,
I don't know. But you know, earlier you mentioned something that we've kind of touched on, and I want to get into a little bit of detail now. Was the Pac-Man care? All right. Well, you have a video on your channel. It was a Pac-Man care video. You got like over 140,000 views on it, which obviously
really surprised me.
Well, it attests to two things. Number one, attests to the success of your channel, which is awesome. Congratulations. But that means people are interested in that content. Uh-huh. So you had mentioned before that you don't think that they're that great of a beginner species. And I agree with you for some of the reasons that we talked about, but I was curious, what do you think makes a good care video? And maybe give us some pros and cons about Pac-Man, why you think they might be a good beginner, maybe why not. run us through your rationale with the species group.
Certainly. So, I mean, it's not that I don't think, I mean, yeah, I think at face value, sure. I don't think they're the best beginner frog, but I say that specifically about Ceratophrys cranewelli, and I guess Ornata as well. I mean, like with these animals, they're like the most popular and most common Pac-Mans you can acquire. And a lot of people don't realize that they estivate. And so like people can kind of get around not providing them with that period. But I think that's where a lot of the problems arise, like naturally where these animals are from. And like, you know, like the Chacoan plains and other areas, like they're going through a lengthy estivation where they're cocooning themselves, you know, and going under the ground and waiting for the rainy season to return, for the warmth to come back. And so the average, in many cases, child or novice keeper that sees a cute little Pac-Man froglet at the reptile show or wherever, or expo, may not understand the implications that when that frog reaches maturity, and usually does so quite quickly, is going to benefit a lot from undergoing that process, or may choose to do so without them really being ready for it. And then they're panicking that their frog is burrowed underground and not coming out and not eating. And then there's the concern of people digging up their estivating frog and disturbing them. So those are the sort of things that I kind of think, they're not really the best beginner frog. Funny enough, in my mind, I actually think firebelly toads are one of the best beginner amphibians to keep, but that's just sort of my opinion, at least. I think they're pretty hardy and interesting and can be pretty versatile in terms of the type of conditions they can be kept in, whether it's more of a terrestrial with water dish setting or paludarium. But anyway, with the Pac-Mans, yeah, I think despite the fact that they're less common, I really like the Cornutas, because I find that them coming from Suriname and different parts of the Amazon, even I think they're also in Peru. They can, from what I've read, they do sometimes estivate, I think, depending on the conditions. But I could be wrong with this, but my understanding is that species doesn't necessarily have to. They can be active all year round if the conditions allow for it, because temperatures, like they have a warm or they have a dry season, but if like they don't always go, you know, into an estivation mode, let's say. So I think that might be conducive to someone not really understanding that process having more success. But then the flip side of that is that Cornuta, in the wild at least, is said to be more of an obligate frog eater, which I haven't really found to be the case at all as far as like receptivity and feeding for the captive animals that I was able to get my hands on. So I have 5 of the Cornuta, and I got them all as small froglets, and that was what inspired me to make the video, because I've seen a lot of people say they haven't had much success keeping Pac-Man froglets, or that a lot of them have died for various reasons. But then I also identified a lot of similar problems that seem to be the case, like whether it's, you know, temperatures being too low and they're not eating, or impactions, which really are a real threat, especially as much as I think moss can be helpful in having the animals feel a sense of security. The long strands of fiber, like sphagnum moss, I think can be problematic for very young frogs if they, you know, miss and swallow a big piece. I have seen them pass it okay, but so yeah, I kind of was inspired to make this care video. And funny enough, I actually don't have very many care videos at all on my channel. And I would like to do more of them. I think I just have a very particular style. Again, touching on what we discussed at the start of the episode here, I mentioned that I really do try to navigate through things as a fellow hobbyist. I don't want to claim to be, you know, infallible, or however I should put it, that like I have the way and you should do what I do. It's more so like, this is working for me, and this is why I think it's a good idea, and perhaps you may wish to consolidate this information and decide whether or not it's fitting for your style of care, etc. And I kind of go about it that way, because I don't want to create content that's going to sit there and be presented as this is the only way to do this. I think that's very important, because when you amass a larger following, you know, you have to be careful. Like, people look up to you and what you're presenting and your standard, and things change, and we're always looking to better it as well. The content, the way of, or more importantly, the style and way we care for our animals is always meant to be improving. So, you know, you put this content out, it stays, you're not going to take it down. You want it to last long. And I think that going about it as this is a way instead of the way allows it to have a better longevity, and also not be something that, like, yeah, people are going to just think is the only way they can do it. So, so I made the video. I wanted to focus on how to kind of get a Pac-Man froglet out of that delicate stage of life. And in one way I've seen people do it, I've seen a lot of Asian producers, they all like to keep their Ceratophrys on foam. You've probably seen this as well, right? And so I know it's not, I mean, in the same sort of sense that we were just discussing, it's not like enriching the animal that is normally an ambush predator and burrowing even. Is not able to do that, but that's also why I added the leaf litter on top of the foam. I think that that's a good way to kind of get them out of that delicate stage where they're more prone to things like maybe impaction and such. And I also think it's important to remember, when we observe these animals in the wild, I can't speak specifically to Ceratophrys, but even in images I've seen, the substrate that they're in isn't loose like coconut husk or cocoa fiber and things like that. They've sort of nestled themselves oftentimes into a more clay-based soil. So I don't think that leaves as much room for, you know, missing the prey item and ingesting a mouthful of substrate as it would in the captive setting. So funny enough, we put this emphasis on having this loose substrate that's easily passable through the gut and whatnot. But I don't think that the animals are often coming into contact with that sort of material in the wild. Like, of course, they're going to potentially eat little random things here and there, and hydration and other factors prevent the animal from getting impacted in a lot of cases, you know, with other species like arid, with sand and things like that. But I just mean to say that I think we also underestimate that sometimes the substrate isn't so loose and accidentally ingested. But yeah, with the Pac-Man video, it was honestly, like I said, just meant to be this is how I recommend raising these frogs into a less fragile size. So froglet to juvenile. And now I'm kind of brainstorming how I want to do the adult video. I was very pleasantly surprised that many people even watched it and enjoyed it. So yeah.
When I used to lurk on the Pac-Man Frog Reddit group or something like that. Like, I don't even have Reddit. Mm-hmm. I would just, you know, you're bored or something like that, and you start looking, and I noticed that seemed to be the stage that people had the most problems with, was people mm-hmm. would get a small froglet about the size of $0.50 or whatever, and then mm-hmm. that was usually when the problems would start. Like, the people who had the big softball, the big, like, baseball-sized frogs, they weren't the ones having the problems. It was always the people who had that intermediate phase between juvenile and adult that seemed to have the biggest issues. And I don't know if that was just because, like we talked about before, the law of averages, maybe there's just more frogs out there that were just more fragile and just needed more special care, or it was people were inexperienced, or whatever reason, that seemed to be that target. I think that was, you know, you hit that mark by providing people with that resource that they really just so desperately needed.
Right. Yeah. And I mean, also, I think another thing that people fail to do is feed them properly as well. Like, my friend Bree, Mike's girlfriend, actually, Bree Roman, she sent me this fascinating paper that documented the stomach contents of the majority of the genus. And it was really cool to see what they were eating, and even at different life stages. Like, they're eating, funny enough, like you said, a lot of beetles, ants, even the cornuta, you would think is what we're meant to believe to be an obligate frog eater, or, you know, have a preference for that in their diet. They're actually eating a lot of insects and even rodents in their diet. So, It is interesting because I find another issue with the Pac-Mans, and I don't want to sound like some sort of expert, but just my observations and you know, as someone who's been in the hobby for a while too, like being part of like Fat Frogs Forum. I don't even know if that's still a thing, but that was like early 2000s. I was on there too. And, you know, people sometimes overlook the importance of supplementation, of course. And especially with a frog that grows that quick, you see a lot of MBD and other issues. So, and that can also be prevented, not just a supplementation, but by offering a vertebrate prey, and the importance of that too. And then, for example, silver sides and whole prey, not just, you know, fillet of fish or something. But, and so like these are things that can actually really help in producing and raising healthy, large, you know, robust frogs. So I did try to emphasize the importance of diversity of diet and actually giving the animals that on top of just say like crickets and little invertebrates that they would come across. Because again, I mean, for a lot of Pac-Man frogs or that genus, they're the start of their story of life involves eating their siblings coming out of the water. Like they're all going to hang out around the body of water where they were born and raised and, well, not raised, but born and then metamorphosed, and then they will linger and eat their siblings. And there's absolutely fascinating, oh my gosh, I wish I could find it. There's an Argentinian Instagram account that I follow that is focused on the conservation of Ceratophrys ornata in the wild. And it's super cool to see all the posts they make about these frogs in the wild. And even from those images, they're not living the way we set them up. Like I could honestly compare it to, from what I've seen. Again, I can't say that they've maybe not set up some of the photos, but the in, you know, in situ photos, it almost just looks like they're Pac-Man frogs around a pond, the way you would find like a leopard frog, or just, you know, they'll nestle in the mud kind of, or in different areas and undercover. But some of the photos look like they're just in a prairie, a flooded prairie. I think they even have a nickname of, I can't remember the exact wording, but that they bite cows' faces while they're grazing in the grass. So that they there's like a kind of like a myth or urban legend that they bite the cow's face and the cow suffocates from the frog just holding onto their nose. So, but the cornutas are the ones that are more in the Amazon. But I mean, again, it's just something worth considering and thinking about in the way that we choose to approach raising these animals.
That's a good point. I agree. I think that a lot of times people, and again, we're all limited because we all live in our own little microcosms. But you think about, you want to recreate nature. Well, what is nature? What does it actually look like? And sometimes it's not what we think it is. And like you said about, it's like almost like a flooded prairie. And then you try to recreate something in that, in a captive setting, and it's kind of boring looking. But even the same thing like with pixie frogs, and they're only out a really brief portion of the year, and the rest of the year they're buried below ground, like sometimes like miles away from the pools that they breed in. And you see people who have these like really elaborate planted jungle setups, which are cool looking, but it's not this dry, cracked section of desert with a frog 5 feet underground buried in a wad of its own mucus where it spends most of the year. But yep. Now I hear you on that. And, you know, while we're on wild observations versus captive, I was hoping we could end on some of your observations, like when you've traveled. I know you've been to Madagascar. You said you mentioned Costa Rica earlier.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it doesn't necessarily have to apply to any specific amphibian species or amphibians in general, but what have you learned about observing herps in the field versus what you have at home?
Ooh. I mean, I always love to try to take in as much as possible, especially if there's a species that I'm keeping in captivity. I want to learn about, the temperatures, the humidity levels, the environment we found them in. And of course it's not broad enough to consider like you know, you have to, in a more scientific approach, collect as much data as possible. And there's so many variables you don't get to consider when you just find one animal in one location. But even with Mike, I love traveling with him because he's always, you know, he's like the go-to guy who's going to bring his UV meter, and then we'll have like a, you know, a thermometer and then measure a hygrometer, like everything. So, I mean, I like to really get in there and try to observe something and something that would be like, you just want to take the information back and help hobbyists, right? Like, and especially with animals like amphibians, it can be so important, and especially like oftentimes they're endangered in some capacity, and anything that helps, that might be valuable information to help reproduce them in captivity, is an asset. So I think really, I don't know, it's just super special to be able to document amphibians in the wild, especially in some of these unique places like Madagascar. Like for me, the most incredible thing was finding Mantella baroni in the wild, and it was unbelievable, truly. Like, it wasn't easy. We had to really climb down this, I mean, I don't want to exaggerate, but it was a pretty steep slope. And again, this is all documented for those that wish to see as much as I could with filming while clambering down this thing, muddy, slippery slope. And we came across this pretty aggressive river. And there's just, again, like just big boulders and pebbles and the same kind of thing. I mean, it honestly reminded me, dare I say, besides the vegetation, a little bit like me frequenting a local river here. Like, I could find a very similar environment local to me, but lo and behold, there were these Mantella there. And I mean, in my mind, I would have maybe imagined it to be more of like what you would expect for, you know, dart frogs on the other side of the planet. But no, I mean, it was kind of just a rapid river. And with Mantella, they, you know, each species is very unique and frequents a different sort of environment in Madagascar. And they are in some ways so adaptable. Like, some of the last ranges found for certain species, like, would have at one point been like a jungle or, you know, old growth forest, and the species is somehow surviving in like a stream and hiding under boulders or something now because the whole area is deforested, right? So there are circumstances like that that just show how resilient those animals can be. But I don't know, I think it is such a pleasure, and it's something that's very humbling, and I don't take for granted to be able to document and see those species, especially with the Mantella, because, you know, the conservation crisis in Madagascar is so great. So just having the ability to have had that experience was something else.
If I could say, we'll give you all expense paid trip anywhere in the world for 2 weeks, where would you go and what would you want to see?
Right now, that's a good question. Where I'm at now, I think I would love to go to Indonesia. I would really like to be able to document, Tribolonotus skinks, the crocodile skinks in Papua New Guinea. And then I would also really love to visit some of the Indonesian islands to document tree monitor lizards. So I think that would be something very special. If I keep thinking about it more, I want to say, oh, well, you know, Australia, I want to visit Australia and then go, you know, from north to east to south and west and document all the incredible herpetofauna there. And I mean, Southeast Asia, there's so many incredible countries, right? But I think, yeah, Indonesia would be amazing. That's not to say it would be my next destination per se, but at some point in life, I would love to be able to go, circumstances permitting. Yeah, I think that comes to mind.
All right. Now, money is no object, 2 weeks, anywhere in the world, but I give you a time machine. You can go back and you can see a species that's extinct. What would it be?
Oh, man, what a question. Yikes. I mean, funny enough, that's really hard. And it's interesting. I'm not sure that it would be a reptile or an amphibian.
Doesn't have to be. It could be whatever you want.
Yeah, no, I know. But I just like, I'm just kind of thinking out loud here. I think, I don't know. Like I'm thinking of animals that weren't extinct that long ago, even in the last just few hundred or thousand years. I mean, for one, I will say thylacines are, I'm still one of those optimistic people that hopes that they're still somewhere out there, whether it's in Indonesia or Tasmania still. But Madagascar also has all these incredible lemur species that went extinct. You know, we had these incredible giant lemurs the size of gorillas that went extinct, or the elephant bird even. And I'm cheating here. I'm listing off all these animals. So I don't want to narrow it down to one thing. But I don't know. I think I'd probably say the thylacine, I guess. But I am, again, optimistic or hopeful that it's not an animal that actually is extinct. But, you know, it's not looking too promising as of now.
I honestly would have given almost exactly the same answer. I'm fascinated with species that went extinct within the past, like, 5,000 years. Especially everything within, like, the past 2,000. Thylacine's one. Dodo bird, the moa.
Yep.
And
oh, yeah, those are great.
I think, like, a Stellaris sea cow. That would be pretty cool.
Oh, yeah, those are really neat.
Yeah, a Stellaris sea cow or... I'm trying to think.
Or even
of
a mammoth.
Yeah, yeah. Well, now there's talk of somebody wants to. I don't really see that as being a realistic option, but that or like, you know what I always thought would be really cool? To go back in time like 10,000 years and visit where I live now and just see what the place was like, what kind of animals were here, what the topography was like. Because I know, like, where I live is changed so much in the past 100 years alone.
Oh,
but
yeah.
I always thought absolutely. That would be really cool. Go to a place that was really urbanized and developed and then go back 10,000 years and see what it looked like before there was any real human presence around to speak of.
Yeah. I'm sure it would be pretty cool. Yeah, I mean, even just thinking about the last few hundred years where I'm from, like, you know, there were probably, it's probably primarily coniferous forest, and the wildlife has just changed so much. It's now all such, there's so many deciduous trees and different species thrive in that sort of environment. Like, the moose have moved more up north. We have more white-tailed deer now because they thrive in this sort of open space, and the coniferous trees grow faster, or sorry, the deciduous trees grow faster than the coniferous trees. So it's very fascinating. But yeah, I mean, also just the species that were still alive then would have been crazy to see. Very interesting. Yeah.
I'm going to give you a book recommendation, and by now it's going to be a rare book. But
okay.
It was, there's actually two of them. The author was Dougal Dixon, and it was, one of the books is called The New Dinosaurs. It was a speculative idea of what if the dinosaurs had not gone extinct, how they would have evolved in the absence of mankind. That came out in 1988. And there's another one called After Man, which is equally cool. It was about zoology of the future. It was speculative, and it had things rabbits took on the role of deer and other cervids, so rabbits evolved longer necks, and it was like hooves, and it's really, really cool. I mean, good luck finding the books because they're all pretty much rare now. Some of them, the original prints are pretty expensive, but if you go on Google, you can see some of the illustrator. I can't remember the name of the illustrator, but if you're interested in alternative evolution. Desmond Morris was the person who did the illustrations. There's a bipedal bat. It's really, really cool. And there's a what else is there? Like penguins replaced baleen whales to become these macro predators of the ocean.
Oh, wow, I'm looking at it now. Yeah. Yeah, on Google Images.
Yeah, it's all pretty cool.
This is very interesting. Yeah, I'll have to look into it.
I feel like there's a little bit of that in all of us. I feel like everybody who mentions people like Steve Irwin and Jeff Corwin and David Attenborough, there's that latent sense of adventure. Like, I want to see this one thing before anybody else, or I want to be the person to see the last one. And this was just such a cool exercise in that kind of fantasy, I guess you could call it.
Yeah, it looks super interesting. I'm looking here now, and I see the penguin reference you were making.
Yeah, there's another one that was man after man, where human beings continued to evolve every other species went extinct.
Hmm.
Yeah, that one's kind of gross, actually. It does not look good for us in the future.
I mean, I can already see it, friend. I mean, I feel like we're becoming less and less mobile in terms of, you know, everything's about, like, technology has been to make things easier for us, but now I think it's going to slowly be to our detriment instead of to our advancement over time. And I don't mean to sound pessimistic. We'll see what the future holds.
No, I agree with you.
I often joke that, like, our destiny is what is portrayed in WALL-E, the Pixar film. Like that's where we're headed at this point. We're going to be blobs on floating, like, hover seats, and just, we'll see.
Yeah. Nothing surprises me at this point. I can only imagine what horrible direction look at Man After Man by Desmond Morris. And that's actually disturbing.
All right. I wrote it down, but
yeah,
I don't want to have nightmares either.
You will. You're going to have nightmares.
I mean, I am very, I like to think, you know, I want to be optimistic. I think humanity has this incredible capacity. It's just what we choose to do with it. You know, we have the potential to do so much good despite how much we've done wrong, but hopefully we'll learn from our mistakes and try to do better. I mean, it's a sort of wishful thinking. I don't know.
No, I agree with you. I try as hard as I can to leave the world, hopefully, a better place than it was when I found it. Mm-hmm. But
that's all we can do.
I mean, we're kind of at the end, but I wanted to just ask you: your channel is doing very well, and it's been great talking to you. You have some great insights, and I was just curious: where do you see yourself in the future? How do you look at doing the channel full time, like 2020, like 2030? Where do you see yourself?
I mean, that is a great question. I think looking ahead that way is so important. But right now, I think I'm looking more at, like, smaller goals. So, I mean, I can, to answer your question first, I think that I do love the idea of doing something on a more brick and mortar. I don't know. Like, I would love to be able to have either some sort of educational presentation route, whether it's a center of sorts that offers, like, programs to children and such. Because at one point I was considering teaching. So I do think that's really important. And on so many levels, you know, educating a future generation is so important. And I'm grateful that I also get to sort of do that in this niche through YouTube. But I think that actually helping inspire and show children the magic and also, again, like, to help teach the opposite of these fears and phobias to kids, you know, like, I think some of it, sure, may be instinctual, but in most cases, I think that a lot of these fears are taught. Like, there are so many videos of little children holding or picking up a snake or a spider, and they're just fascinated. And then the parents react a certain way and teach them that they should be afraid. So I think that, you know, being able to do something there would be wonderful. But going back to my initial point of the short-term goals, right now I'm eternally grateful that I'm able to support myself financially by doing this full-time. However, right now the short-term goals are to really grow it and find the best ways to do that, whether it's different streams of income through different social media platforms, just kind of the more business side of things to be able to attain and even consider those sort of goals and aspirations. Because at the end of the day, like, yes, money is needed to do a lot of this stuff. And so I'm also at a point in my life where, getting more personal, like, I don't own my own house. It's very hard to do in today's market, at least in Ontario, Canada. I don't know about where you're at specifically, but it's pretty rough. So, you know, I think about things like, do I still want to operate from my home like I'm doing now? Like, I'm renting, but I have, you know, my reptile room and everything, and I'm very fortunate that that's all working out fine. But I would love to be doing it either from, you know, like I said, a space that I'm renting, or my own house. And so it's about figuring out which priority comes first. And again, so all of that comes from just being consistent and trying to grow this, and just figuring out those potentials. So that's kind of where I'm at. But I do really love, as I said, the idea of hoping to be able to do something, you know, like seeing whatever. I think my take would be a bit different, but I think of people like Clint, for example, Clint's Reptiles. I really love what he's doing. That really resonates with me, as far as like having sort of somewhere where families and children can come and learn about these animals and come out with a really positive outlook on them. So I think something like that would be great. Yeah.
It's a good goal. You know, it's
thanks.
You're right though. It's hard to, the business sense of it is hard because you want to be able to make a living off of it. But at the same token, you don't want to lose that magic that makes it so worthwhile.
Yeah. The tribulations, or the struggle of mixing, you know, passion and work. But I mean, it is tough. And I mean, again, as I kind of touched on, like, I have different goals and aspirations. Like, at some point I would love to, you know, say have a family. And so you have to think about things in that sense too. It's like, am I then going for the goal of owning my own, like, assets, like having a home that I can, you know, have that said family in? Or am I thinking about, like I said, first, am I going to continue renting my living situation and renting a commercial space to, like, is that the move? Does it make more sense? Does that open doors for the potential of what I can do with my business in a better way? Or am I going to save money by continuing to do it in my living space, but now that's my own living space, you know? So those are kind of the questions, but all the while it's about, like, just staying true to my craft, finding creative ways to continue to grow it. And I am seeing that, and I'm eternally grateful. And who knows what the future holds, but for now, like, you know, I'm trying to be forward thinking and think ahead, because it can't just be living in the moment either, which can be easy to do when it's so busy. You're just kind of, okay, get the videos out. Oh, a year just went by. Like, but yeah, I think that's kind of where it's at for now.
You ever just kind of stop for a minute and you think to yourself, how did I get here? Like,
all the time.
How did I end up here?
Yeah, I mean, all the time. But you know, getting a little bit down on the deep level, is I do have to say, like, you know, as someone who decided that the post-secondary education wasn't really for him, or at least, you know, maybe in the future, who knows? But for now, like, it just feels like, I don't know, like, it just, I think what I do, and I mean, for most of us, I think that's a fair statement, but I think it really does encompass a lot of my identity, sort of. Like, you know, when I think about who I am, part of it is like, I am this, like, I've put so much into this, and it is my passion. It's my love for, and I don't know, like, sometimes, yeah, I think, what would I be if not a content creator? And again, like, the hobbyist and the animal lover comes first, but just to say that, like, I don't know if social media or any way of expressing this interest and turning it into a passion disappeared, I would honestly think I'd have some sort of existential crisis and be like, okay, now what am I? Like, back to the drawing board, because this has been what I've been doing for so long now, and I'm so happy to be doing it. I can't think of anything else, you know?
Well, you created a good thing for yourself, and that's a good start.
Yeah. I hope it. Yeah, I'm really excited to see what the future brings, and I'm so grateful again that, to have all these opportunities. Even, you know, I never would have thought a few years ago that I'd be invited to come onto your podcast, for example. Like, it's so cool, and the connections and friendships you make along the way, it's really one of the best parts.
It's the same thing for me. I remember because I started the podcast in July of 2020, and at the time I was like, I remember I saw your, cause your channel got pretty big, pretty fast. And I remember looking at it like maybe like a year afterwards or so. I don't remember the exact time. And I was like, man, I was like, this guy's huge. It's like, this guy's like, it's like, there's no way. It's like, there's no way I'm going to get him on. And like, it's never going to happen. And now here we are talking to each other. So it's, but yeah, it's nice to, get to talk to people who were into the same thing. And it's been fun talking to you. I'm really glad we got this opportunity.
Oh, thank you, Dan. No, yeah, for sure. It was really a pleasure. And I'm sure hopefully we'll get to chat more in the future, whether it's on your podcast or, you know, other, just chatting wherever. But yeah, no, this was wonderful. I really appreciated the opportunity.
Well, thanks for coming on. Diane, if you could just give a shout out to or mention any, I mean, obviously your YouTube channel's Reptiliatus, but any social media you're on, Instagram, I don't know if you're on TikTok, YouTube, whatever, just maybe run down everything for the listeners, anybody who might not have caught it yet.
Sure. Yeah. No, thank you. So I mean, I'm primarily on YouTube, but also very much, honestly, maybe even more on Instagram. And then I also am on Facebook. I do have a TikTok, but like, frankly speaking, I'm not really posting there much consistently. So really it's just YouTube, Facebook, and Instagram that are the main places that I'm posting content. All at Reptiliatus. Yeah.
All right, everyone. Again, it's been a real pleasure talking to Diane. I'm glad we finally got the chance to do so. And it was a real interesting talk. So hope you guys enjoyed it. Stay tuned. More stuff coming up. Catch up with you again next time.